It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Here's a theory for you. The United States could be the culinary epicenter of the world. Why? Because we Americans are the most open-minded eaters on the planet. And before you tell me about the shame of McDonald's and Red Bull, hang on. Our country, warts and all, was built on the shoulders of immigrants. Our families, us. We come from everywhere, unless we're Native American. Compared to most countries, we're open to just about anything. So stay with that thought, because today it's wines from obscure and foreign grapes, Mario Batali on gelato, and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today, a master sommelier talks about the wave of new wines, little-known ones that work with how we're eating now. I'm going to take a shot at solving the eternal puzzle of cilantro, why some people can't stand it. And we're learning about a summer vegetable dish that could be your best friend. It's French. Need I say more? Well, you know, the depths of summer are upon us, and even people who would never think of eating ice cream are dreaming of Ben & Jerry's in the freezer. Ice cream shows up all over the world, but I have to insist that Italians have a particular way with this stuff. And here to talk us through that Italian way is Mario Batali. Mario, it has been a very long time.
And only sweetened by the fact that it's now over. We're back together.
So, talk to me about gelato, because you're in Italy now more often than I am. What are you eating over there?
Well, there's kind of three ways to look at it. There's the trendy molecular gastronomy people who are out there making odd gelatos with bitter, strange, non-fruity things, which are good in that kind of restaurant experience.
Right.
Then there's the traditional gelato of Florence and Bologna that I'm very familiar with, which is mostly milk and explosive fruits and incredibly intense extractions of nuts and chocolates and stuff like that. And then there's Sicilian gelato, which is made with ricotta, no eggs, and they're similar intense Primizia. They get better fruit earlier than anyone else does because of their southern position and their really sunny disposition. So there's those three. For me, my favorite is still very simple. I love to go taste crema. I love to understand when they really have cocomero or the watermelon sorbet.
Right.
And when I can taste those, I mean, the beautiful thing about Italian culture is even on your way to dinner, you might stop for an ice cream.
Yes, I know. Isn't it wonderful? And after dinner, you always you need a walk.
Definitely.
Right?
During the walk after dinner to the piazza or in and around the piazza, it's enjoying this beautiful gelato, which is the most magnificent thing because it has an almost taffy pull to it when you pull it away as you lick it and then kind of get a little chomp on it with your lips.
Okay, so what's really the difference between the gelato and ice cream?
Ice cream celebrates, like most things American, the abundance of our magnificent products. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your love for it, it's made mostly with cream. So it's fatter, which is, because we have more cream and more dairy, not a bad thing. And it creates a very intense, creamy mouthfeel. But what that cream does is coats your palate, and it often allows a little bit less of the intensity of the flavor of whatever it is that you're looking to celebrate, like a strawberry or a peach, allows a little bit less of the flavor to get to the actual taste buds. So when Italians make gelato, it's mostly with milk, and that lower fat content allows the intensity of flavor to become even more quickly evident on your tongue.
Okay. Are there tricks to getting that kind of intensity? You know, it practically is like a trumpet going full bore.
Yes. Well, it's understanding that often what looks like really good fruit in the store isn't necessarily great for gelato. It's often fruit that might be in the bin on the way out that you're looking for, because you're looking for it to be hyper-ripened. That is to say, a peach can't be just perfect for eating out of hand if you want to make peach gelato. It has to be almost to the point that it's going over, in which case then you really get that super maximum sugar and that super ripe flavor, which when you thin it down with a little milk or cream, in which case whichever recipe you decide to use,
right,
it allows itself to shine a little bit better. So it can't be fruit that's perfect for eating out of hand. It has to be almost on the edge of going over.
You know, I'm thinking about what happens when you leave things like stone fruits, you know, peaches and plums and nectarines, in a basket on the counter, and they begin to almost shrivel, and their sugars become so concentrated, that would probably be the time to use them to make a gelato.
Exactly, and it would be better to wait a day or two if it was almost there, if you're really looking to make the best gelato or sorbetto.
Do you have to use an ice cream machine?
Well, you mean like an electric one? No, you can use the old hand churner just like at the Iowa State Fair. They're all doing the exact same thing, which is very much like cooking. Cooking is heat transfer. This is chill transfer. Keep in mind with gelato, though, you don't want to... Most people's problem in making ice cream or gelato is they tend to slightly over-churn it. It's not going to get as firm as you want it to be in the actual churn. You're going to come up with something that looks like a very thick custardy stuff that's cold.
Right.
Then you're going to temper it in the freezer for 2 hours, and then you have gelato or ice cream.
So what kind of flavors are you doing now in the restaurants?
Well, my traditional big flavors are whatever happens to be almost rotten in the fruit market right now.
You're such a cheap date. I love it.
But cherries. I mean, I'm making cherry ice cream this afternoon out here in Michigan because they are just exploding right now. And I bought a couple pounds that are just starting to get that little raisiny look to their skin, in which case they'll be perfect.
All right, I'm going to get in the car and start driving now, and I'll see you probably around dinner time. Yeah,
you'll be here just in time for dinner.
Hey, Mario, thank you.
My pleasure. Always a luxury to be near you, Lynn.
Ah, have a great summer.
All right, ciao.
Mario Batali's latest book is Molto Italiano, 327 Simple Italian Recipes to Cook at Home. I wonder why not 325. Okay, anyway, you've got to try his sweet corn gelato. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, for an all-sweet corn feast, and I say why not, the proper first course would be my drippy Mexican corn. With apologies to all Mexican people, this is what I named the corn on the cob I first ate at a local Mexican market. Let me tell you how I first found it. In the parking lot of the market, there was this big grill and a lot of people bending over from the waist, eating corn on the cob and being careful not to drip on their shoes. The corn is roasted until it's nice and brown and caramelized. It gets basted with butter and then it gets dipped in Mexican sour cream. It's called crema. And then finally, it's coated in cheese and red chili. And when you taste it, if your mouth weren't so full, you'd be singing the Alleluia chorus. Now, you can have all your friends eating in the exact same posture because drippy Mexican corn's on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, so here's my question. Why do some people like cilantro and some absolutely detest it? I mean, they claim it tastes like soap. I've never been able to figure this one out, but I know someone who might have figured it out. It's food scientist Harold McGee, and I'm going to give him a call. He wrote one of the great books on food science.
Hello?
Hal? Hi, it's Lynn Casper.
Hello, Lynn.
Hey, have you got a few minutes to talk?
Sure.
Cilantro. Why is it some people love it and some people don't?
Really good question.
Yeah. I mean, I keep hearing there's science involved and that kind of thing, but it gets very confusing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I recently looked into this because the question kind of comes up pretty regularly with people. And I have to say that the answer is not 100% certain, but at least we're learning more and more about what's going on, and it's kind of interesting story. So a lot of people in this country in particular really don't like cilantro, but a lot of people do. And all across the world, I would say probably cilantro lovers outnumber cilantro haters substantially. It's used a lot in Asia. It's used a lot in Portugal. And so the question is, why such different reactions? And so I went and looked into the chemistry of cilantro flavor and then talked with a neurobiologist about what might be going on in the brain when we sense those chemicals. And it turns out that the main elements in cilantro flavor are a class of molecules called aldehydes, which are found in a lot of different things. And when flavor chemists study them individually, they have they're kind of like Jekyll and Hyde molecules. They have a very pleasant green aroma,
right,
kind of herbal aroma, but they also have a kind of soapy note to them. So they're not just one single, even though they're single molecules, they don't have single aromas.
Soapy is the thing a lot of people say they taste when they eat cilantro, soap flavor.
That's right, that's right. And it kind of makes sense because if you ask where else in life do we encounter aldehydes, these things that are in cilantro aroma, and the answer is in green plants in general, but also in soaps because they come from the breakdown of fats, and soaps are made by breaking fats down into fatty acids and then doing various things with them.
Right, right.
So aldehydes are in soaps and lotions and things like that. And if in the West we first encounter aldehydes in soaps rather than in cilantro because our culture doesn't eat a lot of cilantro, then the next time we encounter those aldehydes in cilantro, the first thing we're going to think of is soap. And that's so, not a very pleasant thought.
So if you're born in Mexico and you're raised eating cilantro, you'll like cilantro. You won't have that reaction.
That's right. You'll have, in fact, a very pleasant reaction because you will have been eating it from a very early age and you'll associate it with family and meals and hunger and satisfaction and all those things.
Is this like chilies where you can learn to like them and learn to have a tolerance for cilantro?
Exactly, exactly. In fact, when I talked with a neurobiologist at Northwestern University in Chicago about this, he's an expert in what goes on in the brain in these sorts of circumstances, but he also turned out to be a recovering cilantrophobe, so he could, you know, speak from
first-hand experience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he said that's exactly what happened, that he loved food. He didn't really like cilantro the first time he encountered it, but because he was adventurous and because he had a lot of friends who enjoyed eating out, they would go eat in all kinds of restaurants, and eventually he encountered it in Mexican food and other Latin American cooking and Portuguese and Vietnamese, eventually he got to like it.
So are there a lot of other foods like this that we can adjust our palates to?
You know, that's a good question. The one other vegetable that I get really strong reactions to when I'm talking with people about this, especially professionals, actually, is green peppers. There's something about the flavor of green peppers
that
really bothers some people.
Oh, they take over. For me, they just, I put a green pepper in a dish and that's all I taste.
Well, when I was growing up in Chicago, there was a local dish that we called Italian beef, which was very thinly sliced beef on a bun with a sauce that had lots and lots of green peppers. And for me, that's what I think of, and I thought that was delicious. So I love it.
So you love the taste of the green peppers. I have to go back and think what I was eating as a kid. Harold, thanks so much for helping me with this. Now I understand more about what's going on. Thanks.
Oh, you bet. Nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, and have a great day.
Okay, thanks. You too.
That was food scientist Harold McGee. Please check out his seminal book on food and cooking. It is the food science book to have. Well, coming up, it's Daring Pairings and the French Way with Summer. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Just Bare Chicken, all natural with no antibiotics, vegetable-fed, cage-free, traceable to the family farm where raised. Just Bare Chicken. Go minimal. You can learn more at justbarechicken.com. We have these friends who have us over for these incredible meals, and they always pour wine that they think we haven't tasted. Well, the most recent one is a wine from Hungary. It's called Egri Bekavar, and it translates as bull's blood. Well, we just roared because this was the wine that my husband poured when he was wooing me. Now, here's the thing. There are so many wines out there that we know nothing about. Well, sommelier Evan Goldstein has focused on these wines, and he's done a book called Daring Pairings, A Master Sommelier Matches Distinctive Wines with Recipes from His Favorite Chefs. Evan, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So am I embarrassing myself with the bull's blood?
Not at all. No, I was actually smiling and thinking about all these bizarre Red Bull jokes I could make and stuff like that in the current environment in which we live. But I will refrain. But, I remember, too, I mean, Egri Bekavar is a wine that's been with us since the days when, you know, the Eastern Bloc nations were bartering Pepsi-Cola syrup to be able to introduce soft drinks to their world. And the only thing that they had that was of value back to the people at Pepsi was wine. So the people from Pepsi developed their own wine importing business as a direct result of that, and wines like Egri Bekavar were a direct result of that. So I was smiling in absolute, I don't want to say sympathy is the wrong word, but appreciation of what you just described, because I remember that time well.
I had no idea that that's how that came about.
Well, there you go.
Fascinating. Well, you know, you've done this book, and I have to say one of the things that I like about it is you've set out to talk about some pretty obscure wines.
Yeah. What I did this time around was exactly that. I think it's sort of this confluence of, one, an emerging and maturing, albeit slowly, American palate for wines. And we've sort of taken the handcuffs off of the security blanket of what I call, you know, the Big 12, the classic six red grapes and the classic six white grapes, you know, Pinots and Chardonnays and Cabernets that represent the lion's share of what is sold and consumed in this country. And people have become much more open-minded towards exploring, you know, grapes that are a little bit more off the beaten track and becoming increasingly comfortable, because usually where there's exploration and where there's discovery, there's oftentimes accompanying value.
Let's talk about a couple of the selections you might recommend, especially for hot weather.
I would say that, you know, as the weather starts to warm up, a couple of things happen. Number one, Dining Central moves from sort of the confines of the dining room or the kitchen area outside. You know, we all, you know, love to worship the sun when we get the opportunity. And trust me, living in the inner Richmond of San Francisco, that's about 4 days a year. So we profit. And when we go outside and the weather gets warm, you know, my proclivity is to move towards whites. And a couple of grapes that I think would be kind of interesting to talk about. The first one is a grape called Assyrtiko. And Assyrtiko is definitely not on the radar screen of most people, but it will be. It's a grape which is Greek by definition. It's found primarily in Santorini, although you can find it in different places. And it's a wonderful sort of crisp, citrusy grape that comes in different styles, sort of a pure lean style that you would enjoy very much along the lines of a young Sauvignon Blanc or a Pinot Grigio, with a little bit of acid and a nice kind of bite that goes well with salads and such. You have a Assyrtiko blended with other grapes, which can pair well with richer, slightly, you know, more robust preparations of seafood and such. And then there are those with lots of oak and made like Chardonnays and should be treated as such. But Assyrtiko is a fabulous Greek grape and really delicious.
So what would this work with? What kinds of foods?
Well, I would say that you've got a couple of angles here. Certainly things that are, you know, sort of citrusy, creamy, a little bit sharp and tart, yogurt dressings, lemon sauces, things like that work well because it's very much in the nature of this wine's profile to work well there. Dishes that are a little bit spicy and a little bit hot work okay. The acid is a great cut. The wines are not generally super alcoholic, so it pops well there. And then things that have naturally more acidic ingredients. So as I said before, yogurts and creme fraiche and sour cream, pickled vegetables, capers, olives, things like that will show this wine off well.
Okay, so another one.
Another great let's sort of stay in Europe, but kind of flips across the Mediterranean and go over to sort of Italy. And I would recommend another grape called Vermentino. Now, Vermentino is known in several different places of Italy, but probably most renowned on the island of Sardinia,
yeah,
and specifically in an area called Gallura. But what's wonderful about this grape is it's, again, sort of crisp and refreshing. And I would think about it more the way if you're a drinker of aromatic white wines like Gewürztraminer or Viognier or something like that, but don't want something that's quite as pedal to the metal as those are. This is a wine that sort of fits that profile because it has a lot of texture, much
right,
like Viognier and Gewürztraminer do, but it's not necessarily like sticking your face into a lay of Plumeria if you were in Hawaii or something like that. It's not quite as aromatic. It's got a little bit more stone fruit, peaches and apricots, and a little less of that sort of very gregarious tropical qualities that you would find in some of those other types of wines.
Now, okay, so we've got Italy and we've got Greece.
Yeah.
You
want to go somewhere else?
I want to go someplace else, yeah.
All right, well, let's hop continents completely and let's hop hemispheres and jump into a very quick plane and fly off to Argentina. Here there's a grape called Torrontés. And Torrontés is actually an interesting grape. It's a cross of the Malvasia grape with the Criolla Chica grape, which is the Mission grape that we know. And it does particularly well in this part of the world. And it's known mostly in the north in an area called Salta, but it's grown throughout Mendoza and other places. And here is a grape that is sort of the extremes of what we just talked about with Vermentino. So it is voluptuous. It is tropical. It is extraordinarily scented, perfumed, and floral, but much bigger. So it's putting the amplifiers on and blasting it to the nth degree. Really good with a lot of Asian type flavors. Indian foods and Southeast Asian food works beautifully with Torrontés. As do a lot of what we would call sort of that hip Floridian cuisine, the stuff you would find down in the Caribbean, everything
right,
from jerk preparations on fish to more, tropical salsas and things made with mango and a little bit of coconut work extremely well with this wine. And it's also just a really pleasant sipping wine. It's not particularly high in acid, so it lends itself well to sort of quaffing as you watch the clouds go by in a deep conversation with your friends in July. And it goes extremely well with things that we would associate with summer, like prosciutto and melon and a lot of the rich, slightly sweeter flavors of summer, fresh fruit, things like that.
Sounds like the wine for all folks. This is great.
Absolutely.
Hey, thanks so much, Evan.
Pleasure was mine. Thank you so much for having me again.
You're going to need inspiration soon. Right now, you're still over the moon about great summer veggies, so glorious in all their simplicity. But soon, the charms of that simplicity are going to wear thin. And you will remember Martha Rose Schulman. This is the woman who loves Mediterranean vegetables. Martha does the New York Times Recipes for Health column. Martha, welcome.
It's great to be back. I love being on your show.
You know, I'm thinking about some ideas that we may not have come up with for seasoning vegetables.
Well, something that comes to mind, because I do it a lot, is marinating vegetables, cooking them and then immediately tossing them with something as simple as a really good sherry vinegar, olive oil, garlic if you want it. And here's something you might not have thought of: fresh mint. I'm thinking of a carrot dish that I make. It takes 5 minutes. You steam the carrots, you cut them into sticks, steam them for 5 minutes, then immediately toss them with a nice sea salt and the vinegar and the olive oil and slivered fresh mint.
Ooh.
It is just wonderful.
I can
just
imagine.
Wonderful.
Now, you could serve that at room temperature. You don't have to have that
That's
hot.
Right. Yeah, in fact, I do. I serve it as a kind of an hors d'oeuvre. And when my son was in preschool, I used to put that in his lunchbox every day, and he loved it. And here's something that people might not have thought of. When you're cooking broccoli and you have these huge stems and you end up throwing them away?
Never.
Well, don't. Peel the stems, slice them up into thin rounds, put them in a jar, put a half a teaspoon of salt, in that jar, shake it, put it in the refrigerator overnight, and then it'll draw off the water, pour that out, and toss it with garlic, olive oil, and vinegar, and you've got a marinated broccoli stem or pickle that is so good, and people will say, what is this? Everybody loves that.
Oh. So what about the idea of something that we might bake when it's cool, like at night? Anything along those lines?
Well, this is my go-to dish with any vegetable. It's a gratin. It's a Provençal. In Provence, they would call it a tillon. And it's you cook whatever. Let's say you're doing zucchini. You would chop up the zucchini, cook it with onion, garlic, thyme, rosemary, and then cook about a half a cup of rice. Any kind, arborio is nice, but any kind will work. And you're going to bind, and then you're going to mix the cooked vegetable with a couple of eggs and some Gruyere cheese and this rice, and put it in a gratin dish, a 2-quart gratin dish.
So a shallow dish, yeah.
Yeah, shallow dish, a baking dish that you've oiled with olive oil. You might want to put some breadcrumbs over the top and drizzle a little more olive oil over the top. And you bake that until it's firm. Then you're going to let it cool. And you can actually cut that into squares and take it with you to work. Of course, it's great hot. It's great room temperature. It's even good cold. It makes a great main dish. You have a little leftover, cut it into little diamond shapes and serve it as an hors d'oeuvre. Just, I make more gratins than anything. I love them.
You could live on this all summer. You just keep changing the vegetables.
Exactly, exactly.
I mean, I can imagine what that must be like with green beans and zucchini and tomatoes and a ton of garlic. It's got to be fabulous.
Yeah. It's just great, great. And greens are wonderful in gratins. The other day I did one with beets where I didn't use the rice in this. It was just eggs and milk and cheese to bind it. And I sliced up the beets, and I also tossed in the beet greens. And it was so pretty because when you cut it, you had these sliced beets, but it was all, you know, firm. It was really wonderful.
You are so Mediterranean.
I'm definitely very Mediterranean. Yes.
Martha, thank you.
I love it. Thank you so much.
Martha Rose Schulman is the author of Mediterranean Harvest. Now, don't you like the idea of those little bits of gratin as finger food? Try Martha's recipe for zucchini tien. It's on the site, splendidtable.org. Michael Stern dedicate themselves to saving us from those moments when you want the restaurant to pay you because the meal was so bad. You could say that they eat so we don't have to. Well, the good finds they put on their website, roadfood.com, and they bring to us. Hey, Jane, Michael, what's the latest?
We've been in Canton, Ohio, which is a wonderful city to eat in, but it is the best city in the world to find great hot fudge sauce. Let me just say something, Lynn. I'm not even going to give you a chance to speak.
When I
was a kid, you know, back when dinosaurs walked the earth, hot fudge was this grainy, luscious, bittersweet stuff.
Right.
Now it all tastes like melted brown plastic to me. But Taggart's does it the old-fashioned way.
Well, and let me add that not only is Taggart's Ice Cream Parlor's hot fudge just great, the ice cream is great, and the cherry on the top of this sundae, in addition to the maraschino cherry, is the fact that they roast pecans to a crisp and salt them just enough so they perfectly complement the fudge and the ice cream on a hot fudge sundae.
You know, this sounds like the kind of thing you dream about, the ice cream place that looks at every dimension of that experience as an art form. You're roasting the pecans. You're making good hot
fudge. This is not like precious yuppie stuff.
This place has been around about a century, and it's really like the town ice cream parlor.
Does it have that? You remember that smell? Ice cream parlors can have this sweet, clean fragrance. If they ever put it in a bottle, you know, you'd be seducing the opposite sex constantly, kind of thing.
That didn't occur to me until you just said it, but I know exactly what you mean. It's almost like a vanilla smell, and it permeates the walls. It's just wonderful.
Yeah, by the way, where is Canton?
Canton is just south of Akron, where we were just recently.
All right, now we have to go backwards here. And where is Akron?
And Akron is just south of Cleveland, which is just south of Lake Erie.
All right. So is the ice cream experience their whole specialty?
It's the main specialty. However, it's one of the good old kind of sweet shops where they also have sandwiches and hamburgers.
They have olive nut and cream cheese sandwiches cut into little quarters. It's just so wonderful.
You know what? We haven't even mentioned the Bittner, which is their signature fountain concoction. It was invented in the 1930s when a customer dared the staff to make a milkshake so thick that a spoon would stand up in it. This is the Bittner. It's 3/4 pound of vanilla ice cream blended with chocolate syrup and then heaped with those really good roasted pecans that fall off the minute you poke it with a straw.
And you know how Michael goes off on these epiphanies about hot dogs, take up the entire show?
Right.
I am that way about ice cream sodas because that is a rare thing to find done correctly anymore. And Taggart's has the perfect ice cream soda with the seltzer and the wonderful homemade chocolate syrup and, you know, a good black and white soda, as they call it in New York.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Am I hearing panting?
Yeah, we're very excited when we speak to you.
We're panting and drooling. Actually, the panting and drooling is not us. It's our dog, Elmer, who happens to be with us right now.
You've got the dog with you?
Elmer, come here.
Yeah, he's such a cutie pie. He's a French bulldog. He's a cream-colored French.
All right, he's not talking.
Elmer, thanks so much for being with us today. And you too, Jane and Michael.
And you too, Lynn.
Bye-bye.
You ain't nothing but a hound. Been snooping around the door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around the door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more. Oh, Plymouth boy. Oh, listen to them old hound dog.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest book is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, anytime you want, you can check out their picks. Just go to splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our free weeknight kitchen e-newsletter and download some podcasts of the show. And be sure to take a look at the collection of seed stories we've got on the site. We're looking to you to tell us your seed tales. And there's some really good ones up there, like a rare eggplant discovered at the back of Beyond. Well, anyway, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this one's really arcane. Who is Clupeus? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be talking with you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. We're going to be talking with you in a moment. You can join us at 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook or shoot an email, splendidtable.org. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. I have to tell you, I dug deep for this one. The question is, who is Clupeus? Clupeus is the god of herrings. You knew that, right? Now, the scientific name for herring is Clupia or Clupeus. The God Business came out in a New Yorker piece by Oliver Sacks. Herring doesn't get the press it deserves. It is so rich tasting, you can do almost anything with it. I mean, the big deal in Holland in June is the first herring. It's lightly salted and you eat it raw. In Tuscany, field hands used to hang a single smoked herring from a string over the table. And at every meal, they'd rub a slice of polenta over it. That was the big treat of the day. But pickled herring, this is an art form, not to be ignored. Herring with dill and onion in a sweet-sour marinade, This is how a summer night should be celebrated.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
We're talking to you this hour. Get to us online, splendidtable.org, or join us on Facebook, or believe it or not, you can pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. By the way, I want to welcome our newest listeners on WBUR in Boston. Give us a call, guys. Okay, now let's see who has been waiting patiently. We've got Jay on the phone calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Jay, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Great show.
Thank you, sir.
And sorry I missed you when you were down here in Williamsburg.
Oh, I hope I'll be back because... boy, do you guys live in a great part of the country.
Well, I was doing my radio show. That's why I couldn't...
That's why the great voice. Okay.
My question pertains to a kafluti.
Oh, yes. Isn't that a wonderful word, by the way? Doesn't it sound like an orchestral instrument?
Is that the correct pronunciation of the word?
I've heard clafuti, I've heard claflauti, but I think it's clafuti. And of course, I'm famous for mispronouncing, so really I'm not the person to ask.
I have made these things many times, and traditionally, you know, the French make them with cherries, as I'm sure you know, but it's a little French custardy kind of pastry dessert, simply made or deceptively simply made, as in my problems I'm having with this thing, with eggs, sugar, milk or cream, butter, some vanilla flavoring, and then they make it with usually with cherries.
Yeah, or any kind of fruit.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah.
And my problem, I started getting lumps in my batter with the flour, the little white, little floury lumps in the batter. And I'm not, before when I made these things, it was nice, smooth, texturally consistent batter, and I'm not sure what's causing the lumpiness in my batter now.
Okay, basically, the clafuti is you do it in a shallow dish, like even a pie dish, and you have a custard, a little bit of flour to thicken it, and eggs and milk, and then sweetening, as you said, and flavoring, and then the fruit goes in there, and you bake it all together, and it's just, you scoop it out, it's just delicious. The flour is there, okay, to not only thicken the custard, but stabilize it. Okay. If you add flour to liquid, it's very hard to get the lumps out. But if you add liquid to flour, slowly, then you can just whisk it and keep lumps from forming. So could that be the problem?
Well, my first thought, since I had made these things before and they turned out okay,
right.
I since changed the temperature in my refrigerator. And I didn't know if the temperature of the cream or the temperature of the eggs had anything to do with it.
Nope. And you know, some people actually make the batter in a blender.
Well, I tried both ways, and still it came out.
Lumpy?
These little lumps. Yeah, I use all-purpose flour.
Right. I wonder if your flour's got... you're living in a humid part of the country.
Oh, definitely.
I just wonder. I mean, are there lumps in your flour anyway? I mean, when you open the... No.
No, just in these kafluties. Maybe,
I wonder what the heck
you know,
is
I have the kafluti curse on me right now.
You know, I think, though, try this. Okay, let's run an experiment. Sift your flour first.
Okay.
Okay, into a mixing bowl where you would mix the whole thing together. And then what I would have you do is add a little bit of the milk or cream, whisking it in a little at a time until the flour is completely smooth. And then add the eggs and whisk, and then add the rest of the liquid and whisk. And that should do it.
So you're recommending the method of the flour first, add liquid to the flour.
Exactly.
Flour
and
to the liquid.
Sift the flour as well.
Sift the flour. Well, that's what I didn't do.
Yeah. So, but give that a try. I think that'll solve the problem.
I shall. Thank
and
you.
I'm going to keep my fingers crossed, so let me know if it works or not.
Well, I hope so. I love these things.
Oh, they can be absolutely fabulous.
Your show is great, Lynn, and hey. I really appreciate it. Actually, your show precedes mine.
Oh, really?
And I give in transition coming into my jazz show, I give a recipe out following the Splendid Table, transitioning
oh,
into
Jay,
my
jazz
show.
Oh, Jay, that's lovely. Hey, well, Jay, thank you. Thank you for the compliment.
Thank you, Lynn.
You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You can reach us 800-537-5252. Tracy's on the line from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Tracy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I have a bunch of wonderful homemade jams and jellies from my aunt and from a friend that they raised all the fruit themselves.
Oh, brother.
Yes. And so it's a terrible thing to let them go to waste, but I don't really eat jams or jellies on my bread in the morning. So I was thinking that there probably are sauces I could make for meats. There are maybe salad dressings, maybe something I could even do to make cocktails or a drink of some sort.
I think you're way ahead of me.
They don't know how. I mean, I do have one recipe where I make an apricot preserves and cayenne pepper over mm-hmm. over wings or pork chops. But otherwise, I'm not really sure, like, what to do with them exactly.
Think that what you've got there is the extremely flavorful sweet side of anything from a salsa, where you would add to it chopped onions, fresh herbs, like perhaps fresh mint.
Okay.
You might add chili if you want to go that route, but you might add something like a lot of fresh basil with that mint, mm-hmm. a bit of garlic, a little balsamic vinegar. And now you have a sauce that you can actually just have on the table and daub on a piece of grilled vegetable. Now, you know, you imagine that. You take sweet potatoes, uh-huh. you slice them thin, you toss them with olive oil, salt, and pepper, and you slow grill them,
right.
okay, until they're really crusty on the outside and nice and tender, and they can be eaten at room temperature. Imagine just daubing on that sweet potato some of the jam treated the way I just said.
Yum.
Or a piece of fish, or a piece of chicken, or you could use it as a baste. So the idea is you're making a chutney or a salsa, and if you add vinegar to any of those preserves, you're immediately got a sweet-sour sauce that's incredibly delicious because the preserves are so complex. And then you can add more. Like, think about, for argument's sake, peaches. Have you got a peach preserve?
No, not this time.
What have you got?
I've got cherry jelly, strawberry jam, apple butter, cherry rhubarb jelly.
Okay, think of cherry with cut-up green tomatoes and lots of fresh ginger and a little salt and a little vinegar.
Ooh.
Doesn't that sound great?
Yeah, that does sound great.
And what I would do for ideas for the combination of seasonings, look at recipes for chutneys and salsas.
Okay.
And then also look at the seasonings from Southeast Asia and India. Because those flavors are what are going to just make this sing, because you've already got the best-tasting sweet element of any of those dishes.
Right.
Okay?
All right. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. You're so lucky to have those.
I know.
Wow.
I know.
Thanks a lot for a great question.
Thank you very much.
You take care.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye. Email us, splendidtable.org. Go to Facebook or call 800-537-5252. Mark's on the line from Apollo, Pennsylvania. Mark, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have a question. My sweetheart Kim and I have a multi-year tradition of alternatively cooking Monday night dinner for each other. We both like to cook. She's much more talented. I'm much more hardworking. I usually come up with one idea, like a main course, or I recently thought of basil ice for dessert. But once I have my one idea, I never know how to round out the menu. You know, if you have basil ice that you're going to make for dessert, trying to find things to go with it. One week I made a poblano pepper and shrimp corn chowder. And then I was tempted to make, like, corn bread and corn this and
yeah,
corn
well,
that.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, sometimes it's, I know Kim has mentioned, you know, didn't you want to have a starch with all of this protein or something like that?
I get what you mean. Well, you know, the typical idea is that there's something that's the main part of the meal. This does not have to be necessarily true, by the way. But if you're doing the corn chowder, let's use that as an example, okay? since corn is sweet and it is very starchy and the corn chowder sounds like it's going to be a robust dish, a green salad would be a great contrast to that. First of all, it's nutritionally a good contrast. No, it's fresh greens. Secondly, the corn chowder is rich, maybe even tends to have a creamy undertone just because corn can be creamy, if nothing else. An oil and vinegar dressing on greens is acidic. You want to go light on the oil, and it's going to kind of cut through that and be a perfect contrast to it. And then the other thing you might want to do along with that is maybe have a vegetable that you eat first, like even a dish of sliced tomatoes. It's, again, a contrast in flavor. So think about the taste of the thing you first get the idea about, and then think about what's going to contrast it. And if you think about something that's a different color and a different flavor, you're going to balance out the meal. Okay, I think that might help. And also, check out some menu cookbooks.
Okay, great. My Monday's coming up.
I'll be thinking of you.
Thank you.
You are welcome. Take care, Mark.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. What does a rat, a coffee cup, and a psychiatric researcher have to do with each other? The researcher is Daniel Wesson. He's affiliated with New York University School of Medicine and the Nathan S. Klein Institute for Psychiatric Research. So, Daniel, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. What is the link between these three things?
Well, not very much, actually. So, I'm an experimental scientist, a neuroscientist, actually, so I study how cells in the brain process information. And I was performing an experiment one day, recording from the cells in the brains of some small mice, and I accidentally set down my coffee cup a little bit too loud during this experiment. And when I set the cup down, a cell in the brain of the little mouse became active to the sound. And what's interesting and very surprising about this is that those cells are supposed to only be responsive to smell. And you wouldn't suspect that the sound would also trigger the activity, but in fact it did, and that was very exciting. So this was kind of one striking noise, and then I kind of clapped my hands together and clicked a metallic object to another metallic object to make various types of sounds. And in every case, this cell kept responding to these sounds. It was pretty strong, and ultimately what you have to do in science, of course, is to be more systematic. So I set up some speakers and timed them off of my computer to be presented at the exact moment the animal would breathe in the aroma of the odor I would present to the animal, and kept finding these same results. And I'm really supporting the idea that this area of the brain is processing smell and sound together.
So what can you extrapolate from this?
Well, so the first very exciting thing is that olfactory information, every time you breathe in a smell from your environment, whatever it is, it goes from your nose into a little area of your brain called the olfactory bulb, and then some cells go into an area of your brain called the olfactory cortex. And the olfactory cortex is where things happen involving learning and discrimination between different smells. That's what's generally thought to happen in the olfactory cortex. So what this first tells us is that the olfactory cortex isn't just for learning and discrimination of rose from strawberry, but also that it's being modulated every moment based upon what sounds are in our environment. So while we are dining in a restaurant and the restaurant's noisy because the music's very loud, or maybe it's a more quiet, candlelit restaurant, that is going to impact the way that we smell and taste our food. But what this actually suggests is that smell is more than just what we inhale from our plate, but it's also how that activity is changing in our brain while we're also being exposed to random sounds or the voice of a loved one at the dinner table, the music in the restaurant, or even the birds chirping outside.
Are you thinking of any specific applications at this point?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of functional applications for this. You could imagine, for instance, that someone has a diminished sense of smell. Would it be possible to have a little implant in your ear that made a really slight stimulation to the nerve of your ear, helping you smell every time you breathe in?
Really interesting. Daniel, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Researcher Daniel Wesson is affiliated with New York University School of Medicine and the Nathan S. Klein Institute for Psychiatric Research. And by the way, he's created a new word, the combination of smell and sound. He has called smound. The report on his work appeared in the April 2010 issue of Scientific American. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And by the way, remember, call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Wallace Irving, who said, "Statistics show that of those who contract the habit of eating, very few survive." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. The Splendid Table is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. You're going to find information on, well, nearly everything you heard here today on the website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and Jennifer Larson. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.